the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Oil prices are down below $30 a barrel. The stock market is down on Friday. Stocks continued to head down over worries of a slowing global economy and possible Fed rate hikes. All of that weighing on, and what does that mean for corporate profits? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to another special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour as we continue with Forecast 2016. Joining me in the first hour will be Robin Griffith. He is still bearish. He recommends cash. He'll be here to tell you about that, but he sees things eventually improving. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. A lot of stories there. And then Ned Schmidt will be on later on. He thinks gold is at a key inflection point. Oil could be heading towards $100 a barrel, maybe not this year, but the events that are taking place will lead us there. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. It is now that time, 2016. We'll be talking about it all the way to the end of the year when we'll look back in December and say, well, were we wacky or really wise? It is time to do part two of our forecast for 2016. Last year, we looked at the consensus and the outliers, and this year is the Financial Sense forecast for the year. That is going to consume us in totally during the big picture today, but I promise you it's going to be interesting. But before we get to the big picture today, let us talk to Ryan Poplava about the markets. Ryan, the carnage was just as real this week as last week. And ironically, if I had to be honest with you, it feels like August all over again. And to wit, we've touched the lows in August for the S&P 500 and thereabouts for the Dow Industrials and the NASDAQ Composite. But unfortunately, this time we have a new 52-week lows in the Russell 2K and the Dow Transport. So last week on the program, you said it was Chinese economic and currency concerns on top of the trading issues with the implementation of their circuit breaker system that they have in there. You also mentioned that there were some concerns on the economic front in our own backyard with a weak manufacturing data point and also negative comments from the auto industry on a glut in inventory. Oil inventories continue to rise, so the price continues to fall. So is there anything new to add to the story this week, Ryan? Is this just a continuing trend, or do we have some new emergences?
Well, John, I think you hit all the major correction food groups there that we've been dealing with. And
wouldn't recommend them in your diet, would you, right?
No. Abstain. More or less. It was the same problems this week as last week, though. One difference that I really want to point out is that the Chinese have left the yuan fixed rate largely unchanged all this week. And that's currently, I think, around 6.5616. That's the number. I think that's a little bit of a concern that, hey, this was a big major problem. This is why we started correcting back in August. It's why we're looking at a lot of issues of that early last week stabilized and we couldn't rally. We tried many attempts. You know, I think technically there were a lot of attempts this week to rally, and oil and economic news made that difficult. I mean, Friday in particular, John, it showed just a nice rebound from the lows, but it's still not the kind of thrust I typically look for on an intraday basis. But I don't know, just granted, we never got those conditions in August and September. There weren't these, we call them swing days, where the bears take it down in the morning, and then sometime midday, the bulls finally take over and run it up to the close. We closed badly this week. And the next day, the bulls said, we got clobbered. So yeah, the bulls tried in a big way on Thursday, and that was probably the best attempt I've seen this year so far. But yeah, we opened up down on Friday due to weakness overseas. And I would say the first drop in oil, West Texas Intermediate, below 30 since 2003. So that played a large part on top of some of the other economic news that came out.
So why is oil still falling anyway? I mean, haven't we cut enough production in the United States if we base it on a rig count that continues to drop? Isn't there some kind of a price support that's developing there?
You know, the Petroleum Institute initially reported a decline in the inventory data on Wednesday. And so we did get a small rally in energy, but that gave up to the weekly Energy Information Administration report that showed a small increase. And there was actually a rather large build in gasoline and distillate inventories. That's heating oil. So that report gave oil, I would say, just the jab and cross combo. And it's due for a technical bounce. Yes, there's no question. I mean, out of the last 50 days I looked at in oil, oil was down 35 of them. You know, it's just been brutal, John. And we haven't seen the correction let up even at $30, which, you know, technically speaking, you look at big round numbers as either support or resistance levels. It's a psychological thing. I mean, even Jeff Gunlash said on Wednesday, he thinks the bottom is in and he sees 30% upside from here just based on technicals. But, you know, traders took oil down even more on Friday with the release of, there was expectations that the International Atomic Energy Agency's report would essentially clear Iran and just basically say they're in compliance with a curb to their nuclear program, potentially in the future lifting sanctions. But I mean, John, I've been hearing that story since mid-year last year. So this isn't anything new. But again, with sentiment like it is right now, any kind of news release, it's very easy for the market to really just hang its hat on any one indicator and just go with it. But I also think some of the correction in energy was, and in the markets, was economic, as the Empire Manufacturing announcement on Friday showed just a really big drop, John, for January. So that's one of the few fresh January numbers we've seen in manufacturing, right when, you know, we need to see some sort of stabilization. It's been down for like 5 or 6 months in a row. And for this indicator alone, it was the worst level since around 2009. So, you know, yes, you can see there's other strong parts of the economy. There's no question about that. And even in some of these bad numbers, there are composites. So we can look at some of the components are still showing some great results. Like in retail, there's some great results in furniture and housing goods. But, you know, you're going to have a hard time arguing against the U.S. is in a manufacturing recession.
Oh, I can do it even if I don't believe it. I can argue anything. If you
yeah,
give,
some do that.
Yeah, give me, if you give me enough
spout
material.
Garbage.
You know, but that's something Mark Farber was talking about last week in the media. Were there any other major economic announcements this week that you really think hit the tape?
There were a lot, especially on Friday. Besides the weakness in oil and overseas markets, Friday's drop had a lot to do with some of the economic news that came out early in the morning. And like I said already, retail sales was one of them, fell down about 0.1%. The Empire State Manufacturing Survey fell down. So that's a regional New York area, showed that that survey dropped to negative 19.4, just a huge drop. And like I said, that's the lowest since 2009. Business inventories were reported down about 0.2% in November. So we didn't get a lot of positive. There was some positives that did come out later in the day, and that probably helped in that intraday bounce on Friday and probably some short covering for the weekend closing out their positions. But, you know, I think the worst part of this week was Wednesday. And what's interesting is that China's trade data was better than expected. And like I said, the yuan fix had been stable for a few days at that point. Yet, John, the market couldn't rally. It did early in the morning, but then it just gave way. And I think it's because there's been just a real big psychological change here. You know, oversold conditions are not being scooped up like we've seen them in the past. Huge V-spike rallies. We looked at that October 2014 rally. That was a V-spike rally. The August low, September low, those were V-spike rallies. We used to have just these real big rallies when we'd hit these significant support levels in the past. And hopefully that hasn't changed. But, you know, there were many attempts this week to try to do that, and they all failed, unfortunately.
Well, it's earnings season, but it doesn't seem there's been any shift in the trading based on the results this week, especially in the financials.
No. And speaking of earnings, I'm seeing estimates are now targeting around 120 from where they used to be around like 125 just a month ago for the S&P 500. And those are earnings for 2016. You know, we're looking at 2016, obviously, now. If you just put a 16 multiple on that number, 1920. So when you get that, psychology has changed, and comments like the ones we got last week, AutoNation saying luxury car glut in inventory. And then this week, it is the earnings week, kicked off. A lot of companies beat, a few missed, some earnings warnings as well. But there were comments from CSX Corp, the rail company, this week that it hasn't been this bad in their industry outside of a recession. You know, you put both of those together and we see rallies continue to get sold off. But technically speaking, John, that's what I do. We're oversold. Sentiment is extremely bearish. With the last reading I saw from Investors Intelligence polling around, bull camp is around 28.6%. That's pretty low. The conditions are ripe. And I've been saying that since last week. We just need a catalyst, and oil, manufacturing, overseas markets and earnings just haven't stabilized yet to give us that catalyst. And you know, we've actually, John, just talking about ourselves here and how we've managed money, we've been actually moving into the defensive camp since November. We publicly put out our financial strategy meeting. The title of that was the final phase of the bull market. And those final phases, they can last a while. They can also be short, but we've been moving more defensive since that meeting. And since after the August correction into the rally, but we're now outright bears. We fully believe there has to be essentially indicators that point out towards a recession, like the leading economic indicators that we follow, before we see consecutive down years and down months in a market. Also, we look at those stress indexes, and so far we don't see that we're there yet. So we're not outright bears, but we have gotten defensive, and you know, we continue to model the current situation more towards liquidity issues like we saw in 1998, 2011. And I think some of our peers, obviously in the industry, are calling it, you know, we've had quantitative easing, are calling it quantitative tightening. We had, you know, the Fed pull back on all of its purchases. And interesting, we just wrote out to clients today showing a report that I believe the Atlanta Fed put out. They called it their shadow rate. So if they took what the Fed did in adding QE and adding liquidity to the market, if they instead of made that as a proxy for interest rates and said, instead of, you know, purchasing all these bonds and increasing the balance sheet, instead we continue to lower interest rates, say to negative rates, they pointed out that as we've removed that, we've essentially raised rates for the last couple of years around 3%. So we believe that this is a liquidity issue, and we're continuing to point in that direction. Obviously, manufacturing has been an issue ongoing, but it's not a very large percent of our GDP, 14%. And inventory levels, you know, largely fix themselves. Once inventory levels get low, manufacturing starts up again and we replenish those inventories. So we're expecting it. Inventories are always cyclical. So we expect that to come back eventually. And that may be a story for, you know, second quarter this year. So we'll see. But if you call, we didn't see new highs in stocks after those liquidity events for many months, John, and volatility was high after that. So we do anticipate this kind of volatility, and we have been moving into a more defensive area to lower the volatility in our portfolios, as that's the prudent thing to do. We did so last year, and like many in our industry, plan to do more. You know, if we look at any kind of oversold rally here, you know, we're going to look at the quality of it. If it's poor, we'll do more.
And the year promises to be an interesting year, especially for broadcasting news on the subject of the markets and the economy. So look forward to seeing to it. Ryan Poplava, thank you much.
It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is author Ken Fisher. His new book is called Beat the Crowd, how you can outvest the herd by thinking differently. Ken, in your book, you talk about contrary thinking has been a theme that has run throughout many of your books that you have written, but you never overtly addressed it. So in this book, you wanted to address the issue. In your opinion, it's more about independent thinking. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. When I was young a long time ago in a world far, far away, contrarianism was generally thought of then as try to figure out what the crowd's thinking and think that the reverse will happen. In theory, what should happen is what consensus agrees on should be priced into markets and therefore should not occur. But beyond that, theoretically, anything could happen. And the traditional notion of contrarianism seems to me in this day and age to be flat wrong, because it's easier and easier and easier to see the consensus through the internet, to see what people tend to agree on, to be able to build up consensus metrics. And therefore, today there's always the herd, and then there's what I call the anti-herd herd, or the folks that are set up to be the reverse of the herd. So there's really two herds.
Well, since the beginning of the year, stocks have been going straight down. Occasionally, they're punctuated by a brief rally. Joining us on the program from the ECU Group is Robin Griffiths. Robin, let's talk about the stock market. It has not looked good since the beginning of the year. In fact, any place you look. Is this a repeat of 2015?
No, it's going to be worse, because as I said on your program last year, many of the world markets were already in the process of rolling from bull into bear market. And I think now, this year, most people in the world recognize this is probably a bear market. Going from bull to bear is always a process. It's not a one-day event. I mean, even in the U.S. market, which is the strongest of Western world stock markets, quite a lot of things peaked over a year ago. The high for the index itself was about May of last year. And what was happening is the breadth of activity of what was holding things up was getting narrower and narrower. And in the end, it came down to two little acronyms, FANG and NOSH. So that's Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And NOSH was Nike, Oris, Starbucks, and Home Depot. If you strip them out, the market's obviously been in a proper bear market for a long time. But they're large market cap stocks are able to hold the index up. As it happens, though, even some of them are biting the dust. Now, this calendar year, Amazon is now down 11%. So although Mr. Bezos's wealth went up $20 billion in the last calendar year, he's lost a bit now. And of course, as the P.E. ratio on Amazon appears to be 850, it's not exactly a Benjamin Graham pick as a value stock. It was a pure momentum play. And the same sort of syndromes applied to other markets in the world as well. But in my work, I begin by looking at the World Index, actually the S&P World Index, but you could use the Morgan Stanley one as well. That has now rolled over into a pattern of falling and the highs and lows below a falling 200-day moving average. So it's a bear market. And on normal cycle work, the average cycle fits with the U.S. presidential election cycle. It's about 4 years long. And normally, an equity market will fulfill a bull market definition for three straight years, occasionally three and a half. And the bear market part of the cycle is 1 year, occasionally short, sharp, as short as 9 months. But the last bull market from that 09 low was 7 years long, extended by zero interest rates and quantitative easing, and elsewhere in the world, other artificial measures. So we've actually got to correct an artificial bull market. I actually rank not only all markets in descending order of merit and divide them into quintiles. I've been doing that for 40 years. But I now rank all asset classes into quintiles. And of course, if you were in a bull market, at the bottom of the bottom quintile would be cash and inverse equities, or shelling short. Now, I do these rankings in most major currencies, and I usually put the US dollar at the top. So right now, having just done the work, in US dollars, at the top of the top quintile is inverse equities, i.e. shorting the market. The next category is cash. And the only other positions in the top quintile are government bonds. High-yielding bonds of lower quality are being crashed because people have realized you may not get the return of your money, so that the apparent return on your money is altogether less exciting. And the world index, it now comes in the middle of the pack with only two world indices beating it, and they are indeed the S&P, the US, and the Japanese market. But even they are not in the strongest categories. Anything to do with commodities, of course, way down at the bottom category. So the work last year was indicating this. But of course, as you know, we always get a seasonal rally and a depressed low late October. You run up through the new year, especially normally if it's a run up to a presidential election. So for the first week of this year to be as bad as it is, that's very non what the cycles normally indicate. And of course, we therefore sit up and take notice. You are running up to a presidential election. There's nothing much wrong with the US economy, not quite as good as the presidential State of the Union address made it sound, but it's pretty okay as economies go around the world. Yet still the market is biting the dust. The problem with the US market is not the state of the economy. It's the valuation basis that's been put on the stock market. It is, quite frankly, absurdly, very dangerously high. It was about 27 on the so-called Shillery P this time last year. And many of the forecasters think, oh, don't worry, the earnings are going to come through and bring the PE down. Well, the earnings are out and they were bad. It was actually even more expensive a year ago than it appeared to be. And now we're finding out, even Netflix figures came out. That was one of the stocks in FANG. And the figures are not only not as good as were expected, they're definitely bad. So I think what happened is investors hyped themselves up expecting something that can't be delivered. But history shows whenever you buy the US stock market on a P/E ratio above 20, let alone 27, the probability of making money on a 1, 3, 5, and 10-year basis is vanishingly small. And the probability of actually losing some money somewhere along the line is really very high. So what this says is this is not a good moment to do anything clever. Do not yet be brave. There will come a time this year to be brave and go in and pick up a really good company that's really bombed out. But now is not that moment. Now is the moment to say, look, I quite like to hold on to some of what I thought I had and have the money available so that when I'm offered a bargain later on, I can do something about it. I think it was Lord Rothschild who pointed out that in order to be good at the bottom of a bear market, you have to survive the bear market, which means being very cautious at the top. So everything says be cautious. Most equities globally are a straight sale. When you come to the two strong markets, which are the US and Japan, you realize, well, why are those markets strong? And you realize, well, they're the two strongest currencies on the planet at the moment. So really, if you're an international investor, the reason why you'd buy a US market is because you're buying the dollar. Well, you don't need to buy any stocks. You can just buy the dollar. Obviously, the dollar isn't strong every day. It has little pullbacks, but it's on a pretty powerful trend. And I believe the conditions for a near panic or what they used to call a flash crash, the ingredients to have a global flash crash are really very high now, rather like 1987. You come in one day and, oh my God, I didn't know it could get down there. I mean, anyone in the commodity market, they've done that already with the price of oil. Lots of people saw it down to 50 or 40 even. They didn't expect it to go under 30 quite so quickly. And the same with copper, Dr. Copper, you know. Quite clearly, all commodities are in an extreme capitulation phase of a major, major bear market. And that can't happen if the world economy is in great shape.
Robin, when I look at 2015, it was one of the five worst years since 1926. I mean, stocks were down, bonds were down, commodities were down. When you see asset classes, I mean, unless you were in cash, I guess everything was on a downside. We have diverging monetary policies right now. between what the Fed is doing and what other central banks. Do you think that perhaps, you know, the IMF, the World Bank told the Fed not to do this, and they went ahead anyway, if they reverse themselves later on? Or do you think they'll be stubborn enough to go through with rate hikes? Because the argument is made they want to raise rates so they'll have some ammunition the next time the economy weakens or we go into a recession. But if you follow their logic, the very things they're doing could cause the next economy, put it in a recession.
They could. I'm on the side of the cynics. To defend Janet Yellen and her colleagues, though, she did say we are data dependent. If the data says we can do this, we can do this. And looking at the state of the U.S. economy, it wasn't a brilliant recovery, but it was a lot better than most other people had elsewhere in the world. So she's got that on her side, and creep it back up again while you can. I mean, I think the Fed in their statement late last year was inferring that you could expect four hikes in 2016. But Mr. Market clearly already doesn't believe that. The market's only discounting two. And if we get the flash crash, I think you'll find her saying, the data now enables me to take away the heck I had. And although I might not call it QE, I'm going to give you some more stimulus here because it's my duty to do something about this. And other central bankers would have an agenda similar to that too. So history shows that you can't use the economy to predict the stock market, because one of the leading indicators to the economy is the stock market. You can use the market to predict the economy. So the stock market is telling you our economy may be okay now, but it is going to cool down. The global economy is already cooling, and parts of it, China, Russia, Brazil, Turkey, Greece, they're in depression. Right now, they're in depression. And South Africa, you can chuck that in there, too. I mean, they're screaming. And Canada and Australia, with their minerals base, they're not doing that great either. Our numbers, just to sort of calm us down, show that the world economy ought not to go into a depression, but the GNP growth will slow down to something very modest, 1.5% sort of number. And within that matrix, the U.S. may very well be one of the best, if not the best, performer. But 1.5 isn't that great anyway. And of course, in a place like China, if you thought it used to grow at 15 or 10, if it slows down to 4 or even 3, that feels disastrous. And I think that's where we are now. It clearly has slowed down. And the actual number growing is considerably worse than the official numbers show. I mean, the numbers are spoofed in a variety of ways, which you can only do in a communist country where most of the big businesses are semi-government owned. But the figures that don't lie is how much electricity is used and that sort of thing. And they imply that the true growth rate of Chinese GNP is not much more than 3% at the moment. It's still not a bad number for a Western economy, but nowhere near what they used to grow at. And of course, any economy like Canada or Australia that supplies them with stuff, they're not going to be supplying much. So that's a major downturn there. And it's not going to go away. It's quite obviously going to get worse before it gets better. And in this incredibly joined up world that we now live in, it knocks on all around the world. Even the American market is not immune. To a sneeze in China will cause us to catch cold. I mean, Apple, America, and indeed the world's biggest company, makes more money in China than it does anywhere else. So, you know, China sneezes, we catch cold. That's where we are now. And then you can add in geopolitical risks. Wow. If they are not maximized more than at any time in the last, I'd like to know what, I mean, this is war. We've got a war going on here. It's got good elements, like the Iranians releasing U.S. sailors pretty damn quickly, which I think was good. But the fact is, the whole area is desperately unstable. The battle with the oil price, the Saudis quite happily driving the thing lower. I mean, I all of last year was predicting $38 at least for the price of oil. And I wasn't expecting to see it go under 30 this quickly. And of course, just looking at the chart, if you go under one support level, well, where's the next? The next is around about the 20 mark. And this is not good. I mean, the falling oil price isn't going to be passed on very quickly to us consumers, so we'll feel bullish. is actually going to bankrupt a lot of people in the oil industry and the banks that have been funding them. And unemployment's going to go up from that sector. I mean, Shell and BP are laying off people over here in the British market. This is quite scary stuff. Making the predictions on my cycle work has always suggested that the years 2016 into 2017 would be very nasty. And according to my work, the low for the bear market is likely to be October 2017. And sticking to pure technical analysis, the shape of the bear market ought to be a significant scary fall, followed by a major rally, followed by the rest of the fall. Each of those legs will have little fluctuations, and by little, I mean bigger than 5%, but not as big as 10. Volatility will be picking up, in other words, but that shape. And as to the percentage amounts, in round numbers, bear markets are always one of three numbers, 25, 33, and 50%. So a quarter, a third, or a half. Obviously, you need a rounding error, but I mean, if you think in terms of those ballparks, that's how big bear markets are. So just looking at the U.S. indices, NASDAQ looks like 50% straight down without touching the sides. The S&P and the Dow, probably 25%. That's the sort of ballpark I'm looking for. With some of these other markets, I mean, the case of China, the first leg down was a 50% move. Then it had a decent 20-odd percent rally. And now we're into the next leg, which on my work has to be at least 50%. And the speed that it's taking place, if they're allowed to do 7% before they suspend dealing, that's seven straight days and you're there. It doesn't have to take a long time, but we are definitely going to go lower. And on the swing, I'm looking for a 50% move. So I think when we come to Europe, some of the countries, including Britain, will be a bit like the US, maybe 25%. But what's cushioning us is our market is not as expensive as the US market. Our P ratios are simply not up there. So we're cushioned in terms of value on the downside. Obviously, you can work your way through on that. I don't think even the German and the French markets are particularly expensive. But we're all in this bear market together. There's no place to run. So it's take risk off the table. Within managed portfolios, whatever the mandate says you're allowed to go liquid, will go liquid. That money will buy you some real bargains later. The fact that you don't appear to get a return on it meanwhile, well, that's great. At least you've got the return of your money. If you're going to buy a bond for security's sake, well, it better be high quality. It better be government. So, again, a good government. I mean, the US is fine. You don't want to go into any some of these other government bonds. And somebody says, I want to be a trader. I want to be active. Well, spend some time working out what to short. Because anything that rolls over and breaks its pattern of rising highs and lows starts cutting down through moving averages, which start making dead cross signals, that's a signal that you could go short this thing. Or there are some ECFs, which are inverse equities, aren't they? I put them into my model, inverse equities. They're right at the top of the list now. This is an aggressive, active trader. This is how you're going to make some money.
Let's talk about another asset class that, given all the problems that you just discussed here, whether it's geopolitical or on the financial end, what's your take on gold here? Why has gold not responded stronger to the events that you just discussed?
Well, the short answer is because at this stage, more people are saying, you know what, I want to own the dollar. But if you panic currently into a currency, it's into the dollar. And whilst the dollar is strong, gold in dollars is not going to be strong. Gold in lots of other countries' currencies is already in a bull market. Actually, even in the dollar, in the last 3 months, it's been scooping around, making something of a support at just above 1,000, really. But if gold is a commodity, it's already at a 40% premium to other commodities. It's only because it is money and has been for thousands of years that it's not lower than 1,000 right now. And I'm a long-term bull of gold because, bearing in mind how many dollars have been printed, once the world has panicked into dollars, they've done that. You'll then find that the dollar's been overprinted and countries like China will be selling their U.S. reserves because their activities elsewhere in the world, they need the money. And I think you'll find the super strength of the dollar will fade. And at that point, it'll be of interest to U.S. investors to be in the precious metal. It's one of those things, it's just possible that the low is in place. but the significant break of the downtrend hasn't happened yet. And we've been in the downtrend all the way from 1900, basically. If you get the ruler out and put the ruler on the low at 250, you know, all those years ago, and then the next low and the next low, it comes through at half the all-time high at around about 960. And believe it or not, anything that's in secular trends, you're allowed to have a cyclical bear that goes up to 50%, but not more. So in a nutshell, somewhere between right now and 960, I think, is the low for gold. It may be in place, but it may not quite be in place yet. But for as long as we don't go lower than that ruler line, the next surge up will take out the old all-time high, and you'll be talking some number above 2,000. And there are certainly scenarios in which $3,000 an ounce is not stupid. It's perfectly reasonable. But that scenario is a pretty unhappy view of the way the world economy is going to grow. And I think that it would be such a scenario that would require central bankers and politicians generally to say, look, guys, Mr. Market's going to do nasty things to us. It's our duty to step in and stop that happening. If it looked as though the world was going to move to that scenario that would get you to 3,000, then bankers and politicians would almost certainly deem it to be their duty to step in and do something to try and countermand it and stop it happening. What that would mean is we wouldn't be in a free market. To some extent, we're already in highly manipulated markets now, but it would be even more so.
So as you look at this, given the state of the markets right now, the volatility, the uncertainty, the cross currents, the diverging monetary policies, would you get completely 100% in cash, or would you raise some cash? In other words, let's say, Robin, you had some very good high dividend paying stocks. Would you sell them or hold on to them?
The last thing I would sell would be, there are some franchises where the business is better than many governments, and the dividends that they pay are very high, and that's certainly way higher than a government bond. So that's what I would hold on to. And to many institutions, they simply can't go under. A private individual can go totally liquid if he wants to, but institutions can't. A big institution might go as much as 10% liquid. I would certainly go 10% liquid as a private individual. I would certainly hold the money in short-dated government bonds, just as a parking place. And then I would make a list of stocks where I feel that the franchise is super surviving. The world can't operate without these companies. The dividend looks great. And I would try and get good analysis on, well, what's the chance of them actually cutting that dividend? And we've certainly found in the mining of the oil market, quite a lot of these dividends, they seem to be yielding 8 or 9% until the day when they cut the thing out completely. So you need franchises that won't do that. I do feel that to some extent, these franchises, we should try and not only hold what you might call old economy stocks. I don't want to criticize the great man because he's clearly a genius, but some of the things that Mr. Buffett has held so well and for so long, they're very old economy. They're practically bonds, but they're not bonds. I would tend to move more towards slightly more modern economy than that because things change. I mean, particularly take Coca-Cola. I mean, it's gone from being one of the greatest companies on the planet. These days, in most countries where people are worried about diabetes and obesity and all of that, it's almost going to become a pariah like a cigarette or something along those lines. So those wouldn't be the type of stocks I would own for the dividend. But something where the business is very current, we can't really live without what they're selling to us. And even if they reduce the dividend, it's still a long way better than a government bond. I would hold on to some of them, definitely. I also would resist being brave at the moment. If you try and catch a falling knife, you might cut your hand. It's better to let it stick into the floor first and then pick it up.
So, Robin, I'm taking from here, if you own good quality franchises, good dividend-paying stocks, especially those that are paying much more than you can earn, let's say, in a government bond, you'd hold on to those. But on the other hand, you'd probably just raise some cash and sit on the sidelines and wait for this thing to work itself out.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's what I'm saying.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how can they do so, please?
I put some of my work on a website at the ECU Group, I've just created a new one called MAGIC, which is Macro Advice for Global Investment Companies. But I do write a newsletter as well. So if anyone who wanted that, they could email the ECU group and request the newsletter, and I could send it out to them.
Well, listen, Robin, as always, you keep yourself warm over there, and hopefully weather will improve and you'll be sailing soon.
Indeed. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Jim Bianco, president of Bianco Research, joins us today. And Jim, when we spoke to you last in September of 2015, the market had rallied off the August lows by a few percentage points. I'm not sure if we were up maybe around 5%. And we look at the S&P 500. And at the time, you said you cautioned our listeners, be patient. We're not going off to the races here. Probably going to retest those August lows. And you were right. Within a few weeks, we indeed did that. We retested the August lows in late September. And now it looks like you're probably going to be right a second time here, because after today's trading on Wednesday the 13th, we saw a pretty large drawdown in the market. Seems like we're really starting off the new year terribly. Some of the worst starts we've seen in stocks for quite a long time. So the picture for the stock market is not very bright. There's a lot of concern, anxiety out there by investors. I want to get your thoughts. What's your outlook for this year when you look at the stock market? And let's touch upon a lot of other asset classes as well.
I think when you look at the stock market, if you look at the backdrop, it's not good. Earnings are off to, I know it's very early in the earnings season right now, but they're not off to a very good start. The expectations are that on a year-over-year basis, we're going to have negative earnings. Even ex energy, we're expected to have negative earnings growth. The Federal Reserve is more interested in their reputation than the data, because they're insisting they're going to raise rates four times. So you've got higher interest rates coming. You've got a tightening Fed. You've got no earnings growth. Am I surprised the market has sold off 7.5% in 8 days? Yes. Am I surprised the market's going down? No. That's the perfect backdrop for a declining market, is no earnings growth and a tightening Fed. And so it's that simple. Now, it's early in the year. There's plenty of time that one of two of those can change. Most likely the one that would change would be the Fed throwing in the towel and telling us that they're not going to raise rates as much as they think, that the market might be right, and that the market is pricing in one more rate hike between now and the end of the year, where the Fed is insisting on four. But unless or until that happens, I think the market's going to stay difficult. But, you know, this is a little steep, but I don't expect it to rebound in any great shape.
. 2016 is looking pretty much like 2015. Stocks are down, bonds are down, especially in the corporate sector, and so are commodities, with oil prices falling below $30 a barrel. Joining us on the program is Ned Schmidt. And Ned, let's talk about oil, because if you look at oil on the charts, below $30, there's no support for oil until you get to 20. And if you go below 20, the next support is 10. So here we are on this Friday. We're looking at oil prices below $30 a barrel. Let's begin with oil. What's going on? You know, we've seen the drop in rig counts, but OPEC is producing all out. Russia is producing all out. And even despite a cutback on drilling here in the U.S., you got a lot of companies that have to keep producing because they have debt payments.
Well, you have a fundamental situation where the world is probably producing too much oil. But the corrective process has been started. I mean, at $30 a barrel, you cannot afford to drill for oil, quite simply. And what we're going to see here in the first quarter is the banks pulling the plugs on oil companies. We're going to see loan losses in the first quarter. I mean, the banks bragged, that blowhard at JP Morgan, bragging about no loan losses yet, that's going to hit in the first quarter. So we're going to see production come off fairly dramatically. The more important part about where it goes tomorrow or next week or a month from now, that's being driven by futures trade. The real question is, where is the price of oil going to be at the end of the year or a year from now? And I think we're at the point now where we can say that we may not be able to pick the number for the bottom, but next year, a year from now, oil prices are going to be higher. And we're at that point now. Because remember, it's only in dollars that the price of oil is down. A year ago, the price of West Texas Intermediate was $50. So we're off 40%. If you're a consumer not living in dollars, the price of oil is up. A lot of what we're seeing in the price of oil is the dollar illusion created by dollar appreciation that makes commodities look like they're at $30 oil. If you live in Korea, oil isn't $30. It doesn't feel like $30 to you. So part of what we're seeing in the oil prices is an illusion created by the appreciation of the dollar. And I don't care what Wall Street says. No investment game goes on forever. And the dollar is going to be the big bad news story of 2016. And we may have already seen it this week. This week, the yuan, the yen, and the euro are all up versus the dollar. So I think people need to focus on where the price of oil is going to be a year from now, not where it's going to be next Tuesday.
Yeah, because you take a look at what you're seeing from the oil industry. I don't care if it's British Petroleum. All the majors have not only slashed tremendously their upstream operations for exploration, but they're also laying off thousands of workers. And Ned, you and I know that the oil industry isn't like a factory floor where one day you shut down the machines, and then the next day you flip a switch and they go on. You lay off 4,000 workers, 6,000 workers, whatever the number is. These aren't people you can call back on a moment's notice and restart things. And, you know, I think of, you know, we talk a lot about shale oil, but I'm thinking about a lot of those offshore platforms in the Gulf of Mexico or the North Sea, where you have offshore platforms that are very expensive to drill and operate.
Yeah, you can't afford to put a new one in. Now, a company like BP might, or Exxon might, because they're thinking about where the price of oil is going to be 10 years from now. But the industry is collapsing down its capacity. And as you just pointed out, when you try and turn it back on, you just don't turn oil production back on. It is not like making smartphones or widgets. It's a very capital-intensive, people-intensive project.
You and I have watched the oil industry, and I can remember when oil dropped down to $10 a barrel in the 80s, and then all of a sudden we hit the Gulf War. It was back up to 40. I can remember in 1998, the price of oil got down to $10 a barrel. By 2000, 2001, it was at $35 a barrel. So the industry tends to swing to extremes on the low side, as we saw in 86, as we saw in 98, and as we saw in 2008 with the financial crisis. We're lower now, Ned, than where we were at the bottom of the financial crisis in 2008.
Right, and that is a combination of two forces. One, this dollar illusion caused by its overvaluation, and the emphasis on futures trading. And I think that's something I hope someday you'll talk about with people smarter than I am on the subject. But the volatility we put in these markets with futures is destroying our markets as an investment vehicle. I mean, you talk to more individuals than I do. I can't imagine convincing a man and woman 70 years old to put their $1 million in the stock market. And so the trading and the emphasis all shifts to the futures traders.
Well, the problem that you have right now, at least from my perspective, Ned, is you've had the public, basically as of 2009, the vast majority of money has gone into bond funds, and they're waking up to the fact they can lose money in bonds. But so much of what happens in the market today is controlled by hedge funds, large institutions, many of them leveraged. They may go in and take positions in the futures market, whether they're buying S&P futures or any kind of future, either long or short. And it tends to magnify the movements. But one of the big things that we see right now is a mass withdrawal of liquidity from the markets. So when you have liquidity withdrawn from the markets, investment banks are shutting down many of their bond departments as a result of Dodd-Frank regulations. You remove that liquidity, whether it's through dealers or, you know, central banks like China dumping their treasuries or the Fed cutting back on QE, you're withdrawing a lot of money from the market. So it doesn't take much to move the markets. I mean, it used to be it took $300 or $400 million to move the treasury markets. Today, as big as the treasury markets are, you know, less than $100 million can move the treasury markets. We've had swings in the treasury market that are equivalent to 1,000-point drops in the Dow. So we've seen that. I want to move on to another commodity, given all these things that we're seeing. You cover the gold market. Why do you think, I mean, gold's okay on the day you and I are talking, it's up $17, it's at 1090, but it has failed to get some of the major traction it normally would get when you see all the events, whether it's terrorist attacks, whether it's swooning stock markets or bond markets, we have not seen gold gain traction. Is this mainly a dollar phenomenon?
First, let me answer the first thing you said there about gold gaining traction. I would somewhat disagree with you there, Jim. The markets changed in the summer of 2015. There was a dramatic disconnect in anticipation of the rate increase. Since the end of July, the GLD, which is the closest proxy for the individual, is off 1% from July of last year. The S&P is off 10. The NASDAQ 100 is off 11. The Dow's off 10. It has been for the last 6 months gaining relative strength relative to the stock and bond markets. That improvement of relative strength is necessary to precede an absolute move. In other words, the relative strength in an asset price improves before the absolute price improves. So we're seeing gold outperform the markets, stock markets, for 6 months. That is a big statement that I think is being ignored by a lot of technicians. The second, it is the dollar illusion again. The dollar is so overvalued, so overextended, it makes all assets denominated in dollars look like the price is doing nothing. If you went to Canada, any Canadian investor is happy as a pig in mud that he or she owns gold and not stocks because they're up. If you look across the world, the only bears on gold are in the United States. We are the only country bearish on gold because everybody else is doing just fine. I mean, if you talk to the average European that owns gold and ask you, don't you wish you owned stocks instead, they would laugh at you. And so gold is performing, and it's just this dollar illusion. And I know the street says the dollar is going to go up forever, but they told me the same thing about Apple. And so sometime this year, this reality of the dollar, which is crushing American business. Jim, I don't think people understand how hard it is to sell an American product today outside our country. You cannot do it. And that dollar illusion is going to disappear, and gold is going to look like a very successful investment when that happens.
Well, I do know, Ned, that if we take a look at corporate profits, which were down last year, back out $15, which were losses from the energy sector, the rest of it has really come from the dollar. And the danger and risk to that is if you get a profit recession, you know what companies do when they try to protect margins. So eventually, if this lasts long enough, companies are going to start laying off workers, which should catch the attention of the Federal Reserve. But I also want to talk about, I know you look at fundamentals, but the technicians we have in the program are all bearish on gold. They're talking about $950 gold, $1,000 gold. We're talking today with gold closer to $1,090, but they're still talking about that $1,000 gold or $950. Of course, they're looking at charts. Why do you think the technicians are wrong?
Technicians are always wrong at turning points, or as we approach turning points, because a good technician is a pure technician. In other words, he or she ignores with blinders everything going on around him in the world. And so at or near turning points, a good technician, somebody that's been good in the market the last 2 or 3 years, is probably going to be wrong because they've got those blinders on and they're ignoring the fundamentals. We should never use one or the other, technical analysis or fundamental analysis, in isolation. You've got to blend them together. And you've got to understand what's been driving the dollar price of gold is not a bear market, but a bull market in the dollar. And that, it will end. I just can't tell you when. And so what I'm saying is a good technician should be saying what they're saying. But I remind everybody that good technicians, by definition, are probably going to be wrong at major turning points.
Well, I do know that one of the things that strengthened the dollar is when the Fed started tapering and then the talk about raising interest rates, which increased the spreads between U.S. debt and, let's say, what's going on in Europe and the rest of Asia. And I guess, to me, Ned, one of the turning points for gold is when the recognition comes that the Fed is not going to be able to tighten as much as it thinks, because the Fed is saying in their dot plots they're going to be raising interest rates by a full percentage point this year. I just don't see that happening. The economy's too weak, and they would create a crisis. If you take their argument, well, they want to reload the chamber with bullets so they have something to fire in the next crisis, but it doesn't make sense if what they're doing actually creates the next crisis.
I would think betting that the Federal Reserve doesn't raise interest rates at least 50 basis points in the next 9 months is a very risky bet. They keep saying we're going to raise rates. And I think if you're a Federal Reserve historian, like a lot of those members are, they'll remember back. In other words, the event in December at the Federal Reserve has only happened one time in our monetary history. It was March of 1951 when the Treasury Accord came in, when the Federal Reserve first released interest rates. And that was 30 years of rate increases. So thinking about what they do at a meeting this month or a meeting in March, you have to look at what they're going to do longer term. The longer term, rates in the United States are going up. But I don't believe that rates have had anything to do with what's going on with the dollar.
What do you think is pushing the dollar up?
I'm not sure, Jim, but the 25 basis points, the argument being given by the street was that people all over the world are going to move their money to U.S. bank accounts. Now tell me, Jim, if you lived in Malaysia and you had a $200,000 bank, were you going to move it to the United States for 25 basis points?
No.
No, they don't do that. So I think it's been driven by the street, and someday that we wake up this year, and that problem is going to manifest itself because the U.S. economy is getting killed by the dollar. Hey, go back. You cannot sell U.S. products. Take agriculture. Our grain sales are off 16% from a year ago, and that's largely because of the dollar. U.S. soybeans in early last fall were selling for $10.50 a bushel, U.S. $10.50. Today, they're selling for U.S. $8.75 a bushel. So you and I look at that and say the price of soybeans is down. However, if we look at it from the standpoint of a non-dollar consumer, the price of soybeans isn't $8.75. It feels like $11 to them because they are actually now paying more for soybeans than they were 6 months ago because of this phony dollar problem. And we're seeing that across the board. Malaysia, palm oil is the largest vegetable oil in the world, consumed by more consumers than anybody. In Malaysia, palm oil prices are at almost two-year highs because the Chinese and Indians are buying so much of them. But in dollars, it looks like that palm oil prices are in a bear market. So what's happening is we can't sell grains outside the United States, and that because of this dollar appreciation. And quite frankly, the bear market, it's not a bear market anymore, the negative markets in U.S. grains are in dollars, not to our foreign consumers. So this dollar appreciation is giving us an illusion that grain prices are down. On a fundamental basis, though, things are looking better. In other words, U.S. cash corn. Jim, if you'd have bought a bin full of cash corn 7 months ago and put it in your 401k, you would have outperformed the stock market by a double-digit number because U.S. corn prices are flat. And they haven't changed since July of 2014. And the reason for that is the fundamentals on the ground are getting better. low grain prices create high grain prices. And we're going to see grain prices move higher in the United States because we're not going to produce as much of it. Tuesday, the USDA released their first WASD, World Agricultural Supply Estimate, for this year. And it was a very positive report from a price-wise because basically they're saying, we're not going to produce as much wheat, we're not going to produce as much corn, and we didn't produce as much soybeans as we thought we did. So the fundamentals on the ground are getting better, and we're going to see cash corn. I think we're going to be very surprised at the price of cash corn this time next year, Jim.
So given the fact that at this point we still have falling commodity prices and there is this belief the dollar will strengthen this year, you think that is going to change? And if that does, obviously that's going to alter the outcome for commodities, whether it's oil, gold, or let's say agriculture. Given this environment as we close, where would you be putting money? Is it too early to get into the commodity market? I mean, just when you thought oil would be holding at $40 to $50 a barrel, dropped to $30, now it's below $30.
Remember, I believe that oil will be higher a year from now than it is today. What we have are certain circumstances where companies or stocks are being overly punished. And one of those examples is Archer Daniels Midland, which is being punished because of their exposure to the ethanol market, which hasn't been a bad market this year. And it's not going to be a bad market for the next couple of years because the world is switching to ethanol. China has decided that their solution to air pollution is ethanol. You can talk about electric cars all you want, but China has decided that ethanol is the way to cure their pollution problems. So you're going to see China importing ethanol from all over the world. Archer Daniels Midland has been shifting the company's center of gravity to Asia. They're a big owner in Wilmar International. They own the largest grain exporter on the east coast of Australia. This is a company, like, it's off 6% today. You need to look for some of these that are not only down because of what's happened to the fundamentals, but are probably being pushed even farther down because people do expect $20 oil. I would suggest the reason it's off 6% today is because people are talking about $20 oil. Another one is FMC, a stock that I think is being irrationally priced. It's a crop protection company.
Let me ask you this, Ned. Would you be dipping into the oil stocks right now or, let's say, buying gold stocks or bullion at this point?
I wouldn't buy oil stocks yet. I think you got to get the first quarter's earnings reports past you. Gold stocks have bottomed. But that's like putting your hand in muddy water. You don't know what's underneath the surface. I still like the bullion better right now. I would go with the bullion. And in agriculture, I would look for those occasional opportunities that are being created right now, where something's exceptionally underpriced.
Well, listen, Ned, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so. You have two newsletters. You follow the gold markets and the ag markets. Tell our listeners about it.
My gold work can be found at valueviewgoldreport.com. And the agriculture is at agrifoodvalueview.com. And Jim, I hope you have a great year.
You too, Ned. And as always, thanks for joining us here on the program. All the best, sir.
All right. Take care.
Now, coming up next, just when you thought it was safe to make your investments, the second half of the Financial Sense forecast for 2016. Last week, if you remember, we talked about the consensus on the street for the coming year, as well as the outliers, the people who tend to be rogues in making their predictions. And this week, it's time for Financial Sense News Hour and Jim Poplava to make their predictions for the year. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.